Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. And we have lines open for you right now if you'd like to call in, if you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host and you feel like you'd like to balance comment or bring correction, that's fine to do here. The program does not have a set topic, just the broad general range of interests that a Christian audience might have on any topic that's of interest to you. You can call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program today, as I say, our lines are open right now. This is a good time to call. I want to also mention that we have a website that some of you have perhaps never had an occasion to visit. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Over the years, we've had tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people visit that website, and they've downloaded a lot of resources that are there for no charge. Now, I have been reminded by some people that when I say there's no charge for anything on our website, there are other ministries and other groups that say that, but then when you go there, you have to give them your email address and you have to kind of register with them, and then, of course, you're on their mailing list. But we don't have anything like that. We don't have a mailing list. We don't mail stuff out except to our donors. About four times a year, we send out a receipt to our donors, and that's the only list we have. And if you, in other words, if you go to our website and take our resources, you'll do so anonymously, as far as we're concerned. We won't have your email. We won't be contacting you. We won't be soliciting money from you. We don't do that. So just go there without fear that you can take anything you want at our website, and we'll be glad to give it to you without ever knowing who you were. Although, if you want us to know who you are, you can always write to us and introduce yourself and let us know what you're interested in communicating. The point I want to make is that we have about 900 MP3 files of lectures that I've given over the years, verse by verse through every book of the Bible, and quite a few hundred lectures on topics as well. And you may find, if you're curious about some subject in the Bible, that it's covered there. So you just go there to www.thenarrowpath.com. You can also listen to this radio program there, live or later. We have archives going back several months of these programs. You can listen or download those programs there. So that's what you need to know. If you're interested in those resources, they are free to you, as I said. The website, again, is www.thenarrowpath.com. We're going to talk today first to Samuel, who's calling from Monterey, California. Samuel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
I have a question on the Council of Nicaea, and I'd like to know who organized the council and how credible the council were and who all the people participated in the council. And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you, Steve.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Samuel, for your call. Bye now. The Council of Nicaea was organized in 325 A.D. because of a controversy that existed in the church over the doctrine of Christ. There were some in the church following a teacher named Arius, and they were called Arians, and they believed that Jesus was not God. They believed that he was the highest and first created being that God ever made, and that after Jesus was created, then through him God did everything else in the creation. In other words, the Arians believed about Jesus pretty much the same things that modern Jehovah's Witnesses believe about him. They didn't believe in the Trinity. They didn't believe Jesus was God. On the other hand, there were Trinitarians in the church. That is, people who believed that Jesus was part of the Godhead, that Jesus was one of the members of the triune Godhead, and that he and the Father and the Holy Spirit were all God, and that they were all, uncreated. And this difference of opinion divided the church regionally. There were some countries where all the churches followed the Arian doctrine, and there are other parts of the world where all the churches followed a Trinity doctrine. And it was considered to be not a good thing to have the church divided over such a thing as that, and there was a lot of dispute going on between the churches trying to convince each other. And finally, the emperor, I believe, from what I've heard, Constantine, thought it would be best to get the bishops together to decide the matter. And so, at his own expense, the emperor, Constantine, who had only been a Christian for about, I think, about 12 years at that time, he felt like he should gather the leading bishops of the major churches from around the empire and bring them together at this city called Nicaea. And they held a council. Now, I don't know how many members there were of the council. I don't know their names. I think there is record of that information in church history. I'm not sure how much of it's recorded in detail. But it was certainly representatives of all the major churches in the empire were there. And I don't even know how long the council went on. I do know that a very important member of the council was a man from Alexandria named Athanasius. And he was a very strong proponent of the Trinity. And during the proceedings of the Council of Nicaea, from what I've read, at one point it looked as if the council was going to decide against the Trinity doctrine. And the whole church then would basically be officially on the side of the Arians. If that had happened, well, then we would all be, that is, all the churches would be teaching pretty much what the Jehovah's Witnesses teach today. And a lot of us are glad that that isn't the case. But Athanasius was a man who stood up, and he was very staunch and very convincing in his understanding of the Trinity. And he managed to persuade the council back in the direction of Trinitarianism. And so finally, the council decided that the Trinity doctrine was true, or at least the Trinity doctrine. Because it wasn't so much about the Trinity doctrine as it was about whether Jesus himself was God, along with the Father. The issue of the Holy Spirit's involvement was brought up in later councils more. But nonetheless, it was the Trinitarian view that won the day. And as a result, there was a creed written called the Nicene Creed. And these bishops signed to it that they believe that, you know, Jesus was very God of very God, that he was not a created being. And the Arian doctrine then was declared to be a heresy. And that's what the Nicene Council was about, as I have studied it. I don't know all the details. I do know this, that the Nicene Council is often misrepresented. Many times people say that Constantine had a theological agenda, and he wanted the church to teach certain paganized ideas, and therefore he organized the council and more or less guided the council to adopt the view that Jesus is God. I know that the Da Vinci Code gave that kind of an impression about the Nicene Council. And even the Da Vinci Code actually indicated that Constantine there had a strong influence over the decision of which gospels were going to be included in the scriptures and which were not. And just by way of correction, the Nicene Council did not discuss, or certainly didn't make any decisions about which of the Gospels were going to be included in the Scripture. The four Gospels that are in our Bibles today were accepted universally throughout the churches in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, which was before the Nicene Council. So they didn't have to decide which Gospels were genuine, which were not at the Nicene Council. That had been universally agreed upon by the church much earlier, as early as the time of Irenaeus in 180 AD, and a century later, still in the 200s, Origen referred to the four Gospels, which are universally accepted by all the churches throughout the world. So by the time the Council of Nicaea came along, there was no need to discuss which Gospels were to be included, notwithstanding the fallacious claims of the Da Vinci Code. And Constantine did not, as near as I can tell, have anything to say about how the Nicene Council decided the issue of Jesus' deity. And it clearly was not a situation where people got together to rubber stamp the emperor's views. Because, as I say, at one point they almost decided that Arianism was true. But they became persuaded, after much dispute, that Arianism was not true. So it certainly wasn't a slam dunk for the Trinity doctrine there, and there's no reason to believe at all that Constantine had any particular preference or any influence on the way that the council decided its issues. All right, let's talk to Charles calling from San Jose, California next. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to know which day is the Sabbath day, Saturday or Sunday, and how do you keep it and what counselors work?
Okay. Well, the Sabbath day is Saturday. That's always been the case. The Jews and everybody who's ever spoken of the Sabbath in the biblical times were speaking of Saturday, the seventh day of the week. Sunday, on the other hand, is the first day of the week, but the Sabbath is the seventh. Now, as far as how it is to be celebrated, that, or observed, that is a disputable point, because there are people today who believe that we should keep the Sabbath in the same way that Israel kept the Sabbath. And that would mean that you couldn't do any work. You'd have to work 6 days and then rest one day. That's what the Sabbath law was. And also, as you read further into the law of Moses, it says that you need to have a holy convocation, which is a gathering, a meeting, for religious purposes on the Sabbath. So this is how the Jews observed the Sabbath. But the question is, how did the early Christians observe the Sabbath? And that would depend on which Christians you looked at. I think the Jewish Christians in Israel kept the Sabbath probably pretty much a similar way to the way that the Jews did. Because as you read in the book of Acts, the Jewish church in Jerusalem and in Judea were very zealous for the law of Moses, and they kept even the temple rituals. They even went and offered animal sacrifices. These Christian Jews, even after Jesus died and rose again, they were still offering animal sacrifices and keeping the ritual laws of Judaism. So I imagine that they kept it in the same way the Jews did, which was that they just abstained from their work and they went probably to synagogue on the Sabbath day. Now, in the Gentile churches, it was not a given that the Gentiles would do the same thing the Jews did. So that when Paul wrote to the Romans in Romans chapter 14, verse 5, he said that some of the Christians in the church were observing a holy day, and some were not observing a holy day. He said one man esteems one day above another, but he says another man esteems every day alike. And Paul didn't indicate that there was any superiority in one practice over the other. Among the Gentiles, who were never under the law of Moses, they apparently were not required to keep the Sabbath day, because when Paul found that some in the Roman church were keeping it and some were not, he just said, well, let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. In other words, he didn't settle the matter. He didn't say, well, Christians all ought to keep the Sabbath, or that Christians ought not. He allowed liberty in that matter, which means that Paul apparently did not consider it to be obligatory to keep the Sabbath, because Paul would not have shown that kind of flexibility if the issue was, let's say, murder or adultery or theft. He would never have said, well, some of you think it's okay to steal, others don't think it's okay to steal, but let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. You know, he would never have given that kind of flexibility to that kind of behavior. But he did with reference to Sabbath keeping and or keeping any holy days. So it would appear to me that the, as I would understand it, the Christian religion does not impose Sabbath observance on its adherents. And the Gentiles, who had never kept the Sabbath previous to becoming Christians, did not come under any obligation to keep it when they became Christians. But the Jews, who were Sabbath keepers before they became Christians, many of them probably kept the Sabbath after they became Christians too, just to, you know, out of habit and out of tradition and custom. It was in their culture to do that. A little bit like now, you know, there's nothing in the Bible that says people must go to church on Sunday, but I grew up in a culture where we went to church on Sunday, so I do. Now, I don't feel like I have to. It's not a law that I'm required to do, but I go to church on Sunday because that's what I grew up doing. And I think that a lot of Jewish Christians just kept going to synagogue on Saturday because that's what they grew up doing. There was no reason not to. It wasn't, it wasn't an abomination to God or anything like that. But as far as Gentile Christians go, I don't really know of any obligation that we have to keep the Sabbath day.
Yeah, but some people say that the Sabbath was changed to Sunday, because all the denominations practice it on Sunday, except for the Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah, I have heard people say that the Sabbath has changed to Sunday, but there's certainly no biblical grounds for that. The early church, in the end of the first century or the early part of the second century, they apparently held their meetings on Sunday, but there's no reason to believe that they thought that was the Sabbath. Even in the book of Acts, we read of a meeting of Christians that was held in the city of Tyre on Sunday, the first day of the week. But the book of Acts doesn't refer to that as the Sabbath day. You see, I think that very early on, it became customary for Christians to hold meetings on Sundays. But there's no reason to suggest that that was changing the Sabbath to Sunday. Because in the book of Acts, you find the word Sabbath used quite a bit. And this is after Jesus' resurrection, after his ascension into heaven. There's still many references to the Sabbath. And it's always referring to the Jewish Sabbath, Saturday. So we don't find anywhere in the Bible that the Sabbath was changed to Sunday. But we do read, not only in the Bible, but also in early Christian literature, that the Christians sometimes met on Sundays, and eventually it became fairly customary for them to do so.
Okay, what counts as work? Because in the Old Testament, there was a man picking up sticks, and
Right.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, I don't believe that Christians are under obligation to keep the Sabbath. And if we were, I would just apparently do no work at all. You know, I would just sit around and do nothing because I wouldn't want to violate that law. But people always, even those under the Sabbath law, the Jews, and even some Sabbatarians today, you know, they would find ways to fudge, you know, to do certain things on the Sabbath that God himself didn't want them to do. Like in Isaiah 58, he criticized the Jewish people because they were seeking their pleasure on the Sabbath. They might not have been working their jobs, but they weren't devoting their Sabbath to, you know, meditation on God or anything like that. And there are some people who keep Sabbath today who won't cook, but they would go to a restaurant and let others cook, in fact, pay others to cook for them. Which, to my mind, doesn't seem very consistent either. I think if we're required to keep the Sabbath, I think we should do no work on the Sabbath. That's what the law said, do no labor, do no work on the Sabbath. And, you know, in the old days, I mean, in my grandmother's day, there were blue laws in some towns where stores couldn't be open on Sunday because they thought that was the Sabbath. And when Christians a lot of times wouldn't even cook on Sunday, because they thought it was the Sabbath. If you ever saw the movie Chariots of Fire, Eric Little, who was an Olympic athlete, wouldn't run on Sunday because he thought that was the Sabbath. And so, in the older days, let's say two generations ago, when people thought of Sunday as the Sabbath, many of the observant Christians wouldn't even cook their meals on the Sabbath, or on what they called the Sabbath. Now, that is probably the right way to observe the Sabbath if you're going to observe it. However, the Sabbath is Saturday, but I don't see any obligation for us to keep the Sabbath in the New Testament. The New Testament never commands it. And for that reason, I don't spend much time worrying about what kind of work I can do or can't do on Saturday.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye now. Let's talk to Rick calling from Salinas, California next. We have some lines open for you also. 1-800-438-5090. If you have a difference of opinion from the host, always welcome to present it here on these airwaves. Give me a call. Or if you have a question about the Bible or Christianity, likewise, give me a call. We'll be glad to talk to you. 1-800-438-5090. Okay, Rick, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, how are you doing, brother?
Good. Good to hear from you.
What I've got to say kind of pertains to the Sabbath also.
Okay.
Concerning the Ten Commandments, I feel that the Ten Commandments are still in effect, and the Fourth Commandment was to obey the Sabbath. And I don't see anywhere in the Bible where that was retracted. Now, when Christ hung on the cross, Moses' law is what was completed. in that respect. That's my understanding.
Yeah. Now, but what does it mean that his law was completed? I mean, what does that mean in terms of keeping the Ten Commandments?
Well, the Ten Commandments are still in effect. I mean, obeying the Sabbath, which is Saturday. Now, I'm not Seventh-day Adventist or anything like that. I'm a non-denominational Christian.
Uh-huh.
But I still believe that the Sabbath is Saturday. And I don't see anywhere where that was retracted or I don't believe that somebody's going to lose their place in heaven because they don't observe the Sabbath. But it doesn't seem to be the right thing to do. You know, that's the way I see
it. Do you work on Saturday, or how do you observe the Sabbath?
Reading the Bible and just focusing on the Lord.
Okay, so you don't work on Saturdays?
No.
All right, well, that's good. That's good. I disagree with your interpretation because I don't believe that the Ten Commandments as a group of laws has been imposed as part of the New Covenant. I believe the Ten Commandments were the centerpiece of the law that God gave to Israel when they came out of Egypt. In fact, he introduced them by saying, I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and you shall have no other gods before me. And in Exodus 31, God said that especially keeping the Sabbath was the sign of the covenant between Israel and himself. So the way I understand it is that the Sabbath law, along with the Ten Commandments in general, was a set of laws that were given to Israel during the time of, from Moses' time on until the time that Christ fulfilled the law with his death and resurrection. Now, what has replaced the law, in my opinion, is Christ and his lordship. Now, I believe that every true Christian is obligated to follow Jesus and to obey Jesus. Therefore, obviously a Christian can't commit adultery because Jesus forbade that. A Christian can't murder or steal or bear false witness because Jesus forbade those things too in his teaching. A Christian can't blaspheme or dishonor their parents because Jesus taught that way too. But Jesus never said anything about the need to observe the Sabbath. And therefore, since the Christian's obligation is to follow Jesus, not to follow the Jewish law, I personally don't see any place in the New Testament that would enforce Sabbath observance.
Well, Jesus obeyed the Sabbath.
Did he?
And in fact,
you think he did?
Yeah, I do.
But he broke the Sabbath, the Bible says.
Excuse me?
But the Bible says Jesus broke the Sabbath.
Well, that's what the Pharisees or somebody else said, because he did healing on the Sabbath.
Yeah, well, here's what it said. Here's what John said. This is not what the Pharisees said. This is what John, the writer of the Gospel of John, said in John 5:18. Therefore, the Jews sought all the more to kill him for two reasons. Because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father. Now, John says that Jesus broke the Sabbath and said that God was his Father, and for those two reasons, the Jews sought to kill him.
Well, I don't know how he broke the Sabbath by saying God was his Father, because that was the truth. He wasn't lying.
Oh, I know that, but I'm just saying that John, I'm just saying that's what John tells us.
The Sabbath, in my understanding, my interpretation of that, he was
accused
of breaking the Sabbath. But even on his death, he was crucified on Friday. He didn't even rise back until the first day of the week, which was Sunday.
Right.
You know, so he even observed the Sabbath in his death.
Well, he did observe much of the law of Moses, but he also retracted some of it. Like, he said that all foods were clean. He said what goes into a man's mouth doesn't defile him. And Mark's gospel says, thus Jesus declared all foods to be clean. So there's some of the laws. Well, Paul also says that, right, in 1 Timothy chapter 4, but Mark said it in Mark chapter 7. And so, you know, it's found more than once in the scripture. So Jesus declared all foods clean, and John tells us that Jesus broke the Sabbath. But you see, let me make something clear. People who keep the Sabbath and think that we must are usually offended when I say that Jesus broke the Sabbath, because they say, then you're saying Jesus sinned. No, I'm not. I'm not saying he sinned. Sometimes a policeman with his lights flashing, his siren on, breaks the speed limit. But he's got authority to do that. He can violate the speed limit because he's authorized to do that under certain circumstances. And Jesus said that he was Lord even over the Sabbath day. And so when Jesus violated the Sabbath, he did what he had the right to do. He wasn't committing a sin any more than a policeman's breaking the law when he exceeds the speed limit and he's in pursuit of a criminal. You see, Jesus had the authority that was higher than the authority of the Sabbath, and therefore he did what he was supposed to do regardless of what day of the week it was. And that's what he said in that context of that verse I was mentioning. He said, my Father works hitherto and I work, which is the answer he gave them when they accused him of healing on the Sabbath. He said, well, I do my work on the Sabbath and every day because my Father does his work every day. And so he, on another occasion, said he was Lord of the Sabbath. So he was able to do what he was going to do, regardless what day it was, because he had the authority to do that. So for Jesus to break the Sabbath was not a sin. And yet the Bible says that he did break the Sabbath.
Wow.
Now, we can say my interpretation is that he was only accused of breaking the Sabbath. But the way it's worded in John, John's the one who says he broke the Sabbath. He didn't say Jesus was accused of it. He said Jesus did it. Now, I don't care if a person keeps the Sabbath or not, because I don't think God cares if they do. But if it's in your heart to keep it, then it's the right thing to do for you. But I don't see anywhere in the New Testament that Sabbath observance is commanded.
Okay.
Well, I feel that we're still to obey the Ten Commandments. And it is something that, like I said, it's the fourth commandment.
Right. I understand your reasoning. I guess I just can't figure out.
See where it was retracted. That's all.
Where was the law of animal sacrifices retracted?
Well, that was part of Moses' law. That was
right.
See, and also in the Ark of the Covenant, the Ten Commandments is what was kept inside.
Right, but that was the Ark of the Old Covenant.
Moses' law laid alongside of it. And that's
yeah.
what was hung on the cross when Christ completed it. That was what he completed. So there's no more animal sacrifice. He was the final sacrifice once and for all.
Okay, so you're saying that the laws that were engraved on stone were permanent, but the laws that were not engraved on stone were not permanent.
Yes, sir, because we still shouldn't murder. We still shouldn't covenant another man's property or wife or commit adultery or so
That's
on
true.
And so forth, and Jesus followed all of those laws and he wrote them.
Yeah, I think he followed those laws because those were moral laws, and that's why he reinforced them. He reinforced the same moral code that was in the Old Testament, and not only that which was written on stone. You probably would believe, as I do, that homosexual sexual relationships are sinful, correct?
Correct.
But that's not in the Ten Commandments. That's in the law of Moses that was written down that you say was fulfilled.
Well, the Bible does say another man should not lie with another man.
I know, but that's but that's in the law of Moses, not in the Ten Commandments. Likewise, I would assume you believe it's wrong to practice witchcraft.
Yes, sir.
But that was also in the law of Moses, but it wasn't in the Ten Commandments. You see, there are many people like yourself who think that the laws that were written on stone are permanent, and the other laws that Moses wrote on parchment are not permanent. And yet, we don't really follow that, do we? I mean, because we realize that there are laws that Moses wrote down on parchment that are not in the Ten Commandments that are still permanent. So we have to decide, well, if some laws are permanent and some are not, where is the dividing line? How do we decide? And my understanding from the way I read the New Testament is that the moral laws are still in force. It doesn't matter if they're written on stone or on parchment. If they are moral laws given by God, morality never changes because God never changes.
Yeah,
but
true, and he's written laws upon our hearts through
right.
our consciences. We understand
That's right.
how to live properly.
Right, but see, the way I would understand it is the laws that are not permanent are the ones that were ceremonial. And the ceremonial laws our laws about holy foods, holy days, holy places, holy rituals, which are not, those are not moral issues. Those are more, they have to do with the protocol of worshiping under the Jewish faith. And I believe that the Sabbath, yeah, but see, I believe the Sabbath is in that category. I think the Sabbath is a ceremonial law, just like the Passover or any other holy day is. You see, the Sabbath was a weekly holy day, but the Jews also had monthly holy days, the new moons. Every month there was a holy day on the new moon. And then there were annual holy days, the Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles. And all of them were holy days, but and they were all equally holy days. But I believe that the holy days are part of the ceremonial law, and that would include the Sabbath. So that I, when I decide which laws of the Old Testament are permanent, which are not, actually it's not for me to decide, but when I try to discern, it's the moral laws that I see reiterated and reinforced by Jesus and the apostles, and the ceremonial laws they don't reinforce. And the Sabbath is one of those that they did not reinforce. And when Paul spoke of the Sabbath, he spoke of it along with the other ceremonial laws, like in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. Paul said, don't let anyone judge you concerning the food you eat or the things you drink or festivals or new moons or Sabbath days.
No,
he said these, you know, so he seemed to include the Sabbath day along with the new moons and the festivals and the food laws. So I think that Paul's Sabbath is a ceremonial law.
100%, but you know, as the Spirit leads you, that's all I can say, you know.
Yeah.
And it's been a real good show, and you're very informative, and thank you for taking your time and speaking with me.
Rick, thank you so much for calling.
Okay, brother.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
All right, let's talk next to Trevor, who's calling from Portland, Oregon. Trevor, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Brother Steve, how are you?
Good to hear from you.
Good, thanks for having me on. My question is not about the Sabbath, but is actually about your understanding of 1 Corinthians 11 and the passage about the head covering, and whether or not you think it's something that we should obey. I have a hard time when I read the passage understanding if it's a command that women should do it. What specifically at the end of the passage when he says,
verse 16,
that you know, if anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, and what you think that means. And also have a couple of questions about modest dress, but I guess I'll let you answer that one first.
Okay. Well, in chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians, around verse 4 through 16, there's this discussion of propriety of women and men when they're praying or prophesying, which not everyone agrees whether Paul is talking about just activities inside the church meetings or if he means at any place, like at home or anywhere. But my impression is he means in the church meetings, but I couldn't prove that because there are differences of opinions. But certainly praying and prophesying are things that elsewhere in 1 Corinthians, Paul seems to associate with the church meeting. And so he says that it's inappropriate for a woman to pray or to prophesy if her hair is not long and if her head is not covered. Now these are two separate things apparently, because he said if a woman, casts off her covering, she ought to also shave her head, because it's, you know, the long hair and the head covering are both given for the same purpose. And then he says the man, however, is, it's a shame for him. And it's dishonoring to his head if he covers his head or has long hair while he prays or prophesies. Now, at the end of that discussion, now he talks some other things there, gives different, reasoning for it and all, but at the end of it, as you mentioned, he says, if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of Christ. Now, like you said, that last line is pretty important for interpreting the permanence and the universality of the duty.
Right, right.
And yet that last line has been taken different ways.
Right.
When Paul says we have no such custom, what it seems to me that he's saying is these customs that he's been advocating among the Corinthians, for the Corinthian women to wear their head coverings and for men not to when they pray and prophesy, that those customs are not universal customs, not even in Paul's day were they were not universal. That's what it sounds like he's saying. But some people have said that what Paul is saying is we have no other custom than this. So if anyone wants to be contentious, they're going against the whole church worldwide. But Paul didn't say that. Now, it's interesting, the NIV, for reasons unknown to me, has translated it, we have no other custom.
Huh.
But the word other is not in the Greek, the word such is. And therefore the NIV has absolutely no justification for doing that. And I've even read commentaries that were based on the NIV that had to say, when they were talking about this, they'd say, well, the NIV is quite wrong to translate that way. Because Paul says, we have no such custom. Now, one interpretation that some people have given that statement is that Paul is saying, if anyone is contentious, we have no such custom. We don't honor the custom of being contentious.
Right, right.
You know? But I don't think that's what he's talking about either, frankly.
That's a little problematic.
I think it is. I don't think it's a very natural way to understand it. I think the most natural way to say it is, I've described these customs, I've described the reasons why I think you should follow them. But if somebody really is having a hard time with it and wants to contend about it, it's not worth fighting about. It's not a universal custom throughout the church. Mm-hmm. I believe what Paul is saying is that it's a Greek custom, and Corinth was a Greek city. But other Christians of other cultures didn't follow that. And one culture that didn't follow it was the Jewish culture. And Paul himself tended to follow the Jewish culture, at least more than not. And we read in Acts chapter 18 and verse 18 that when Paul left Corinth, after being there for a year and a half, he shaved his head because he'd had a Nazirite vow. Now, according to Numbers chapter 6, a Nazirite vow is where you don't cut your hair. So Paul spent a year and a half in Corinth, and we don't know if he had the Nazirite vow for the whole time, but it was sometime while he was there, he took this Nazirite vow where he grew his hair out long. And then he shaved it when he left. Now, that's a funny thing, because when he wrote to the Corinthians, he said, don't you know for a man to have long hair, it's a shame for him, there in verse 14.
Yeah.
But I think what he means is, in your culture, it's a shame for a man to have long hair, because that's a woman's style. However, in Paul's culture, it was not a shame, because a man, if he took a Nazirite vow, grew his hair long. And Paul grew his hair long because he had a Nazirite vow. And then when he got to Jerusalem, there were four Christians there that had Nazirite vows that James asked Paul to pay the fees for as they went to the temple to shave their heads and offer the sacrifices associated, and he did. So the early Christians in Jerusalem certainly didn't have anything against a man having long hair. It was actually a mark of their devotion to God. And so I think what Paul is saying is we don't have this custom that I'm advocating. I'm advocating because it's the custom of your people. It's the custom of your area, of your region. And I'm asking you to not, you know, offend the locals. And that's what I think he's saying. And, you know, it's interesting because the three chapters immediately before that, chapters 8, 9, and 10, have a similar concern where he tells them about eating meat sacrificed to idols. He says it's okay to eat it, but he says if it's going to offend people, don't do it. And so he spends three whole chapters talking about something that's it's okay for them to do, but he says he's advocating that they won't do it because he doesn't want them to offend people. And now, immediately after that discussion, he talks about the head covering issue and apparently is urging them to not conduct themselves differently than their culture does in this matter because I think it's in order to not cause unnecessary offense in the culture. But he does give the disclaimer at the end, but if anyone's is contentious about this, it's not worth fighting about.
Huh, yeah, that's good. Okay, I think that pretty well answers my question I had about the head covering. The other issue I wanted to bring before you was that about modest dress and specifically the adornment of like precious metals and pearls.
Yeah.
I think it talks about it in 1 Timothy 3 and, or 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Peter 3 maybe.
It does, yes. Uh-huh.
And so I was wondering, you know, maybe is it wrong to have a golden wedding ring? Is that adornment? And what kind of issues, do you see that are practical today about being modest with our dress?
Good point. Well, I have known of some groups that I consider to be rather extreme who don't believe in wedding rings or any jewelry at all because of these statements of Paul's. I consider these groups to be taking Paul further than he cared to. It's the problem we have in our nature, is in our human nature, is that we tend to be legalistic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where Paul is trying to speak to a spiritual heart issue,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, there's no way for him to speak to it, or I shouldn't say there's no way for him to, but the best way for him to speak to it is to give concrete examples of it. A lot of times we'll take the examples and make them into laws, and not recognize that Paul is speaking to a spiritual matter. In 1 Timothy, as you mentioned, in chapter 2, it says in verse 9, in like manner also I desire that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but with which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now, Paul says, I want them to adorn themselves, not so much with the jewelry and the costly clothing, but rather I want them to adorn themselves with good works. Now, I think that Paul did have some particular styles in mind that he found inappropriate for women in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And from commentators and stuff that I've looked at, apparently the Roman women and in the Roman world, the women did have these extremely elaborate, the rich women at least, had these elaborate hairstyles. And they had, you know, threads of gold and silver and stuff woven in their braids and jewels and, you know, embedded there and so forth. It was more than just, you know, wearing a necklace or wearing an earring or something like that. After all, earrings were not forbidden. Under the Jewish law, a slave was supposed to wear an earring. And nose rings also. Abraham's servant gave a nose ring to Rebecca as a wedding gift. You know, I mean, the rings and, you know, moderate jewelry and so forth never really was considered to be immodest. But you know, a lot of bling, you know,
yeah.
a lot of jewelry and so forth, it's just there to get attention. See, here's what I consider about modesty. We often think that clothing is not modest if it shows a lot of skin or if it conforms too much to the shape of the body. And that may be true. I mean, those may be good definitions of modesty, but only partially. I think there's more to being immodest than simply having a lot of skin showing or having your clothing tight. I, by the way, don't think it's a good idea for Christian men or women to have their skin tight clothes and especially women having a lot of skin showing. I say especially women because of men's particular propensity to be distracted by sight. Men often have more of a problem with that than women do. But men have to be careful about that too. I mean, because now more and more women are being conditioned to be attracted visually to men. It used to be more of a male thing. But we need to be mindful of the fact that the clothes we wear could stumble people. That is, it could give them difficulties in keeping their thoughts pure.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, there's more to it than that, because I think it's immodest to do anything, to behave or wear anything that in such a way as to just draw attention to yourself.
Right.
You see, people use clothing, they use jewelry, they use loud speech, they do a lot of things to get people to notice them. And it's just it's not modest. I think a modest person is a person who is not trying to draw too much attention to themselves. So that even if a person had a muumuu on, you know, which very few people would consider that to be immodest, but if it was, you know, I don't know, if the color or the print on it or something was just wild and zany and calculated to get everyone to look at it, you know, that might cross the line into immodesty as much as wearing, you know, more form-fitting clothing that is less attention-getting. I think attention-getting is perhaps the issue there, although, of course, in some respects, we think of modest clothing as particularly the kind that tries to get sexual attention.
Right.
But, I mean, immodest clothing. But I think the Christian goal is to kind of fade into the crowd. I mean, not so much that you want to be totally nondescript or never noticed, but that you're not trying to stand out like a sore thumb. You're not trying to, stick your head up above everyone else so that everyone will notice you. It's being a Christian calls us to not be so much about us, not to care so much about how many people notice us. It's more of a matter of the heart. And that's why I say that sometimes people take Paul's words where he gives an example like this, and they'll make it a legalistic law, where I think what Paul's concern is, as in all of his teachings, is the condition of the Christian's heart. But of course, the way your heart is will dictate to you standards of dress and of behavior. And a thoughtful Christian, I think, will probably try to choose their clothing, and if they wear jewelry at all, they'll choose their jewelry in such a way as not to be so much calculated to just turn heads.
Mm. Do you have time for one more question, because it's somewhat related to what we're talking about now, at least the way it's answered?
Well, my lines are full, but if it's a quick one.
Okay, well, did you say if it's a quick one?
Well, if it can be handled quickly, yeah.
Okay, well, I just wanted to ask quickly then, how does it, a lot of people use the way you've answered the modesty questions and try to say specifically, you know, well, this is something that he gave specific examples in an attempt to relate to the culture, and that's the same reason that he says things like, I do not permit a woman to teach a man, because it's cultural, and that it's something that is only applicable to what was going on in his time. And do you think that's the case?
You know, it does take some discernment, and it takes some wisdom to decide which things in the Bible are to be followed rigidly as a law, as a moral issue, and which things are cultural things that are simply examples of how a Christian attitude was to be lived out in that day. I mean, Paul's frequent reference to greet one another with a holy kiss, obviously,
yeah,
we don't take it as a literal thing. But when Paul talks about the leadership of the church, when Paul talks about the qualifications for the bishops or the elders, he always has them be men. And this is not because he was following culture, because actually the Greek and the Roman world had priestesses in their temples, and the Oracle of Delphi, who is a highly respected pagan religious figure, was always a woman. And so certainly Paul was not trying to please the pagan culture by saying that, you know, women are not to be in the leadership roles of a bishop and an elder. And when Paul talked about those things, he actually appealed not to the culture, but he appealed to the creation. He always said, because God made it this way. He said, because God made man first, and made the woman second, and he made man to be the leader and the woman to be the follower. And so, I mean, if you look at, for example, the passage we were at a moment ago, 2 Timothy 2,
right,
in verses 12 to 15, he talks about this. He doesn't base it on the question of culture at all.
Right.
He doesn't even make any reference to culture. He makes reference to the creation and to the fall, which were unchangeable historical facts that Paul felt set the trajectory for God's purposes in setting up the church as he did.
Hmm. That's good. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for your call. God bless you, Trevor.
You too. Right.
Okay. We're going to talk next to Lori, who's calling from Santa Cruz, California. Lori, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. Hey, I agree with you on what you guys were just talking about.
Uh-huh.
There is an extreme to that too, as well as the modest part, because even the churches that wear the long sleeves and tell you that you have to, that men have to shave their beards and their mustaches, that is an extreme, because the long sleeves and the long skirts and even the hair, and I don't judge them, but I know I went to, that was the first assembly, because I'm non-denominational, and because I didn't have a long skirt on, and I was just worshiping the Lord and just enjoying, and I don't care what they wear, but it was pointed out because I wore capris, which go down to almost the ankles. I came to back up a youth night. I was judged for that, and there's an extreme on that, and Paul was addressing the different churches because of the different issues in each church.
You were a visitor in that church?
Yes.
See, that's a strange thing. See, I believe that, the churches have every right to have standards among themselves. That is, the people who belong to a church, and they say, okay, this is our church family, we're all committed here, we all agree that we want our sons and daughters to dress a certain way, and that we are, as their parents, will set a good example in that area and so forth. I mean, I think a church group, I think any group of people who commits themselves to work together in a community sort of way can set whatever standards they feel are, you know, desirable to them. But when somebody comes as a visitor who doesn't meet their standards, there's certainly no reason for them to judge, because there isn't anything in the Bible that says women shouldn't wear pants. You know, I mean, it may be that a particular group of Christian people think, you know, we think dress, we like to see our women look like women, we want them to have dresses on. I mean, we might not feel like that's, you know, where we'd go, but I see a church as having every right, if that's what they want to have among themselves. But if somebody comes in among them that isn't committed and isn't a member, and they make that person feel judged because they didn't know or didn't follow their dress code, that to me is a sad situation. I don't think the church is helping when it's doing that.
No, and you were talking about the jewelry, and that's what made me think of that one and another fellow, because jewelry can be also worshipped. And so you made a point on the jewelry thing. And another fellow who had went to that church, he ended up going to the same church I did, him and his family, and they actually told him, he, in order to come to this church, he had to shave his mustache and beard. And
wow.
That is, I mean, how are you going to get, and I ended up calling the pastor and I said, look, God forbid a person comes in there that has holes in their jeans and you tell them they can't come here and they're looking for Jesus.
Yeah, amen.
It's sad that churches are that legal. To me, it's just like I told the pastor, my jeans aren't going to get me into heaven and your long sleeves aren't going to get you into heaven. God looks at our heart. You know, my arms were covered, you know, let's get extreme here, but my heart was towards Jesus, and that's why I went there, was to seek him, not to seek the appraisal of men.
Well, a lot of churches, you know, they're looking at, not as God does, but they're looking at man as man does. You know, man looks on the outward appearance.
Yes, they're perceiving as men and not as in the, because so many people are lost, and then they wonder why their church isn't growing.
Yeah, that's too bad. You know, I heard a story some years ago of a pastor who was preaching in a Pentecostal church, if I'm not mistaken. And he looked down and saw in the front row there were some women in very short skirts sitting in the front row. And he suddenly became animated, and he began preaching against immodest clothing. And he, in the course of saying that, he said, if you wear miniskirts, you're not welcome in this church. Which, I can hardly imagine a preacher saying that, but this actually happened. And after the service over, those two women, of course, very embarrassedly got up and left. And a woman who was a member of the church came up to the pastor and said, Pastor, did you see those two women who were with me? They were prostitutes I invited into church today. And they were reluctant to come in, but I told them that Jesus loves them, and I brought them in.
Yes.
But, of course, the pastor drove them away. Which, I mean, I guess Christians do their share of really stupid things.
What you just shared real quickly, there was...
I'm out of time. I'm sorry. The music's playing. I really would like to talk to you more.
God bless you.
Call me again sometime.
God bless you.
God bless you, too. I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm off the air here about 30 seconds. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. We are a listener-supported ministry, and so if you'd like to help us pay for the radio time, that's where the money goes. Again, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find the resources I've mentioned earlier in the program at our website. Free to you, nothing for sale. It's www.thenarrowpath.com.